You can find and purchase bump music for today's show at issuesetc.org and click Listen on Demand.
Girls will be boys and boys will be girls. It's a mixed up world, up shook up world. It's up world.
Is this the new normal? Is this here to stay? The transgender agenda appeared suddenly, rose suddenly, and, well, pretty much took over suddenly. There's no doubt about it in terms of the medical community. Where do they stand on it? The legal community, where do they stand on it? Our politicians and our laws. Is this the new normal? Is it here to stay? And how do we explain the meteoric rise of transgender activism and influence? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're going to be talking about transgenderism. Joining us to do so, Dr. Ryan Anderson, a regular guest, William E. Simon Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation and author of several books, including his latest, When Harry Became Sally, Responding to the Transgender Moment. Ryan, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be with you.
How do you explain the meteoric rise of the transgender movement in political influence, in social acceptance, even in the medical community? How do you explain that?
I mean, so part of this is that there's been a fairly well-orchestrated and well-funded campaign amongst activists for the past decade or so. It was only a decade ago that the first pediatric gender clinic opened, and now, 10 years later, there are 45 gender clinics that focus on transgender identity, in particular for children. We saw, right as the Supreme Court redefined marriage, LGBT activists pivoted from the LGB part of the acronym to the T part of the acronym. The Bruce Jenner interview, as Jenner was then called, that aired the weekend before oral arguments at the Supreme Court. So here you have the timing almost seamless to go from lesbian, gay, bisexual issues to transgender issues. And then a year after the Supreme Court redefines marriage, you have the Obama administration send out its Dear Colleague letter, redefining the word sex to be gender identity, and telling all public schools in the United States that they now have to do all of their policies based on gender identity rather than biological sex. These things don't just kind of happen as happenstance. They're not organic grassroots efforts. These are well-orchestrated, well-funded, well-coordinated efforts, first to redefine what marriage is and now to redefine what a man and a woman is.
Your book had simply been in the publicity phase, not even out yet, and already people were responding to it by simply saying, look, Ryan Anderson is a classic bigot. He is a bigot in every sense, and the proof is he wrote this book responding to the transgender argument. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think unfortunately what we're seeing from some voices on the left is an attempt to shut down any discussion of gender identity issues before they even happen. It's really remarkable that the response to this book by people who haven't even read the book is so intense, because activists want to silence and shame anyone who questions transgender ideology. But there's much too much at stake to remain silent, because what's at stake here is nothing less than the human person. How do we understand what it means to be a human person, to be male or female, to be a man or a woman? More importantly, to be a boy or a girl, because it's that transition from boyhood to manhood, from girlhood to womanhood, that is so fraught. I mean, that's a difficult developmental process for anyone, even in the best of circumstances, in the best of cultures. And what we now have are gender ideologies being promoted at schools across the country that are making that process that much more difficult. So I wrote this book to help people think about these issues more carefully and then to respond to people in need more charitably.
I want to talk about several ways that the transgender phenomenon manifests itself, but let's start with what I kind of, I don't know, I shouldn't call it, but a classic case. The case that is often presented as the only way this happens. It is a person who says, a man who says, when I was born, I was misassigned my gender. I know I was born and the doctor thought I was a boy, but really, truly, I was born a girl. And I am going to do everything I can have done everything I can to correct that mistake and live as a woman. And I deserve for society, for politics, for the laws of this nation to recognize that fact and maybe even to give me a little extra special protection since the world is full of people who don't understand who I really am. How do we go about dealing with that?
A couple of thoughts in response to that. One is that we need to recognize that someone who believes what you just said is obviously suffering and struggling. They're not just making this up. They're not just doing this out of a sense of like a lifestyle choice or rebellion or something like that. If you would go to such a drastic action as to amputate certain of your body parts and to take hormones and to have surgery to transform your body, it's obviously coming from some deep-seated struggles in life. And so the first response is one of compassion, one of love and respect directed at the individual. Even if ultimately we disagree with some of the choices that the individual will be making and some of the demands that the individual is going to be requesting of the rest of us and of the rest of society. Because as far as the science goes, there's no compelling evidence that this individual was born in the wrong body. Or, you know, the way you phrased it was that his gender was misassigned. Because gender isn't something that's assigned. Sex is a bodily reality based upon how our bodies are organized. The various organs and systems of our body, organs are organized, and that's how we have organisms. And you're either organized in a male pattern or in a female pattern. You either have a functioning Y chromosome or you have two X chromosomes. You either have male reproductive organs or female reproductive organs, male sex hormones or female sex organs. And that then shapes your entire bodily existence. And that's not assigned at birth. That's something that can be recognized on an ultrasound image. That's something that can be recognized at birth. It can be recognized through blood testing. It's a recognizable reality, not something that's merely assigned, which is why it's not surprising that we see people who attempt to transition, attempt to have their sex reassigned, frequently don't have good outcomes. Because sex wasn't assigned in the first place, it can't be reassigned. And so when you look at the outcomes for people who have transitioned, we show that people who identify as transgender, 41% of them attempt suicide at some point in their lives. People who have had sex reassignment surgery are 19 times more likely to die by suicide. These statistics are tragic. They should stop this headlong rush into transitioning, and they should prompt all of us to think of and to support more effective ways of preventing these outcomes. And so one of the things that I discuss in the book is what alternative therapies for gender dysphoria look like, because they don't get the attention, they don't get the mainstream media coverage as the reassignment therapies do.
Let's talk about some of those alternatives, especially with respect to children, because in many cases, and increasingly many cases, we are not talking about full-grown men who decide to transition to live as a woman. We're talking about children who genuinely are confused. That's part of that headlong rush you're talking about, isn't it?
Yes. So there are two types of personal narratives that are important for our listeners to know. There are desistance stories and there are detransitioning stories. And so the first one, desistance, you can think about the opposite of persistence, the popular phrase, she persisted. Well, for gender dysphoria in children, it does not persist. For the vast majority of children, according to the DSM-5, this is the kind of the handbook for mental health care professionals, somewhere between 80 and 95% of children will naturally grow out of a period of gender confusion, that their genderphoria will desist. This means that for 80 to 95% of children, if they're just allowed to go through the normal process of development, they're not given puberty-blocking drugs, they're not given a new name, a new pronoun, a new wardrobe, they're not given the opposite sex's sex hormones, estrogen or testosterone. They're just allowed the time and the space to go from a 7-year-old boy who's not a stereotypical boy to being a 9-year-old boy who more readily identifies as a boy, their gender dysphoria goes away. So that's the desistance story. The detransitioning story and this was the hardest chapter of the book to write, many people who have transitioned later in life try to detransition. They recognize that they made a mistake. And the most heartbreaking stories involve people who transitioned as teenagers, 14, 15, 16-year-olds, who were told that they were a boy trapped in a girl's body or vice versa. They took the puberty-blocking drugs, they took the cross-sex hormones, and then 5, 10, 15 years later, they regret it. And they try to transition back. But once you've amputated certain body parts, once you've removed certain internal organs, once you've exposed your body to the opposite sex's hormones for a decade, there's only so much that medicine can do to restore you to wholeness. And so it's a very delicate situation, and which is why it's important that we're able to actually think about these things and discuss these things calmly and rationally. And I think that partly explains why the activists, you know, already started attacking the book before it was even released, and you know, dozens of one-star reviews were posted, et cetera, et cetera.
On this Wednesday afternoon, we're talking about transgenderism with Dr. Ryan Anderson, author of several books, including his latest, When Harry Became Sally, Responding to the Transgender Moment. When we came back, he had mentioned names and pronouns. What do we do when he wants to be called she and John wants to be called Joyce? Do we accommodate that?
He's only being what he wants to be. Now his life is rearranged, and he's grateful for the change. He's out of the wardrobe, and now he's got no regrets.
Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills, too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the language of medicine and law today. Visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR17. Memoria Press, a classical Christian education that works.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Technology. Diversity, family breakdown, gender confusion. Think for a moment. What are the most pressing issues facing Christians today? Whatever the issues may be, chances are good that the writers and editors of the Lutheran Witness magazine will be talking about them and helping readers see and understand them through Lutheran eyes. Subscribe today to the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's flagship magazine at cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
This is Pastor Clint Poppy, Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Lincoln, Nebraska, proud supporter of Issues Etc. Each month we host the Nebraska Lutherans for Confessional Study, a serious study of Lutheran theology. We generally meet on the fourth Thursday of each month from 9:30 to 2:30, and both clergy and laity are invited. There is no charge to attend. For more information, please call the church office or visit our website, goodshepherdlincoln.org, and click on the green NLCS tab.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
For 28 years, I had the privilege of serving as a chaplain in the United States Navy.
Dr. Dan Gard, retired Rear Admiral and President of Concordia University Chicago, on the need for military chaplains.
During that time, I was able to bring word and sacrament to so many young people and their families, our sons and daughters spread throughout the world. Truly a privilege and an honor, and today there are other chaplains that must follow. We need more LCMS chaplains in all branches of the military. It's an incredible, amazing mission opportunities to go to places no other pastor can go, but to go with the same tools that any other pastor brings wherever he goes, word and sacrament.
You can find out more about the vocation of military chaplain at lcms.org/armedforces. The LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces, lcms.org/armedforces.
Looking for girls who are boys, who like boys, who think
girls, you two boys, my bad girls, you two girls, my bad boys.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about transgenderism. Dr. Ryan Anderson, author of the book When Harry Became Sally, Responding to the Transgender Moment, is our guest. Dr. Anderson, you had mentioned before the break names and pronouns, and this is one I think a lot of people struggle with. So you know someone who is transitioning or attempting transition. He wants to be called she. John wants to be called Joyce. Ryan, do you accommodate that or not?
It's always going to be case-dependent and situationally determined. And what I mean by this is that the most important thing that you can do for someone is to maintain a long-term relationship. And so if I have a family member or a friend who's transitioning, if day one I use the incorrect name or the incorrect pronouns to that person's face, that may shut down a relationship that will never recover. And the most important thing for me is to be in relationship with this person precisely to try to play the long game of helping them restore wholeness. That said, you don't want to enable someone. You don't want to encourage someone in a false identity that can also cause harm. Nor do you want to kind of promote the idea that sexual and gender identity is fluid or exists along the spectrum. So when speaking about people in the third person, I wouldn't use incorrect pronouns. So persistently and consistently say Jenner rather than him or her. But if forced to, acknowledge the reality that Jenner is a man who identifies as a woman. As far as first names go, I think first names are a more conventional matter anyway, and so you can typically defer to what a person wants to be called. Someone's technical legal first name might be Robert, but they prefer to go by Bob or Bobby. None of us object to that. And so simply as a matter of deference, normally I would defer to their preferred first name. But the whole way of thinking about these things in whatever situation you find yourself in is, how can I both bear witness to the truth, encourage a long-term return to wholeness, and not stigmatize someone, not offend someone, not destroy the possibility for a relationship?
Could it be as simple, and we're talking here then in the context of a personal relationship, could it be as simple as saying to the person from the very outset, I know that you want to be called X, and I know that you want to be referred to with, say, female pronouns, and I'm going to do that with you, but I'm not conceding to that reality. I don't believe that that is real, but I'm going to go ahead and do that for you because I do want to stay in relationship with you. I do want to continue the conversation and simply put it up front like that. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, that may be one way of achieving this balance. And I know lots of families do this on lots of issues, so we shouldn't think of gender identity as like one uniquely difficult issue. It's a difficult issue, but we have lots of places where we disagree with family members and loved ones, where they're making choices that we think are mistaken, but we find a way to kind of live alongside them with that. And so whether this could be a situation where you disagree with divorce and remarriage or cohabitation, whatever it may be, you don't always kind of pick that battle. And so in the same way here, if you have a loved one who's transitioning, you'd be like, look, I don't think this is in your best interests. I don't think this is going to bring you long-term wholeness and healing. But if this is what you're going to be doing, I'm going to be supportive of you, even while I try to persuade you that you're making a mistake and something better for you is out there.
Would an exception to that perhaps be that case of the children, where, again, because we're dealing with a state of, in some cases, extreme physical and mental emotional immaturity in the children, not their fault, their kids, that would only confuse the issue more?
Oh, of course. Yeah, I mean, so I've been operating on the assumption that here we're talking about adults, because
right.
Certain reality here is that we live in a free society in which adults have to be able to make their own mistakes. And so we can't, if Bruce wants to be Caitlin, I don't think the government should tell him that he can't. I don't think we should try to, you know, forcibly get in his way. I do think we should try to say, Bruce, look at someone like Walt Heyer. Walt Heyer transitioned, lived as a woman for 10 or 15 years and then detransitioned, and we'd like to spare you some of the suffering that Walt went through as a result of that. But in the meantime, if you're friends with Jenner, you're probably going to need to say Caitlin. You're probably going to need to have a relationship in which you can remain close enough to Jenner to play that role in that life. But for children, the nature of these relationships are entirely different, because what children need are parents. What they need are guides, role models, people to tell them when they're making mistakes, who will prevent them from making mistakes. We don't allow children to decide whether or not they're going to eat candy or vegetables, whether or not they're going to watch TV or do homework. We wouldn't allow children to just decide what they're going to do on any other issue. And so when it's something as important as medical care, whether or not a child is going to be receiving puberty-blocking drugs, this is where I actually think the place here for parents is to say, no, you're making a mistake, and we're going to find a different form of therapy for you. We're going to do what Dr. Paul McHugh, the psychiatrist at Johns Hopkins, recommends. We're going to do family talk therapy. We're going to do expectant waiting, but we're not going to encourage you or use pharmacological agents to perhaps lock in your transgender identity.
You mentioned Walt Heyer. He's a frequent guest on this program. And if I remember his story correctly, he attributes much of his confusion as a young adult to the way he was raised and actually dressed as a girl by, I believe, a grandparent, and kind of on the spectrum of abuse, said this had something to do with it. How common is that? Not that particular thing, but maybe sexual abuse or some other kind of abuse in people who find themselves in the transgendered moment, as you say?
So no one really knows how common that situation is, because there aren't any long-term, robust, randomized, systematic sociological studies of people who identify as transgender. And so to kind of, you know, really be able to say how common something like that is, the social scientists will need to be studying this for a lot longer and with more robust methodology. But what we do know are largely kind of anecdotal stories of people who have written to Walt and told him about their story transitioning and detransitioning, convenient samples, a different type of sociological methodology. And those show that sexual abuse plays a role, but it's certainly not the only role. I go through in chapter 6 of the book, and I look at some of the clinical evidence. And so there's a clinic in Canada that specialized on treating children with gender dysphoria without transitioning them. Their specialty was actually doing the psychotherapy that would help a child come to accept and embrace their body. And they found that it could be things as simple as a boy who is more effeminate, more sensitive, more into dolls than into trucks, who's being bullied by other boys in his class. And he hasn't formed any strong male friendships. And so as a way of coping with the male bullies who are his age, he can come to identify as a girl, because the girls are nice to him. The girls don't pick on him. His interests line up more with stereotypical girl interests. And the treatment there is to talk through, why do you think this means that you're actually a girl trapped in a boy's body? One of the courses of response would be, introduce this boy to other boys who aren't bullies. You know, expand his, not just his knowledge of what it means to be a boy, but his direct experiences by having other boys who are sensitive, boys who share his interests, so he can form other male friendships with people like him and see that he can be a healthy, happy boy. In another case study, it involved a mother who had two children, a daughter and a son, and she had been a victim of sexual assault herself. And as a result of that sexual assault, she had developed an aversion towards men, and she was inadvertently taking this out on her male child, on her son, to such an extent that he picked up on it. And so he was identifying as a girl to try to win over his mother's affection. And so in the course of family therapy, the therapist was able to say to the mom, we need to work on your unaddressed wounds. You need to do healing from your sexual assault. And then after they were able to help the mother process what she had experienced, she was able to be more affectionate with her son. Her son was able to identify as a boy. In both of these cases, those children were spared a life of visits to an endocrinologist, being pumped full of the opposite sex's hormones, simply because of a developmental struggle.
Where does the medical community stand on this as we speak?
The official kind of experts on gender identity fully embrace a standard of care that says children as young as 2 or 3 years old should have a social transition. A social transition being a new name, a new pronoun, a new wardrobe, access to the new bathrooms and locker rooms and sports teams. Then children at age 9, 10, 11 should be placed on puberty blockers. Children at 14, 15, 16 should be administered to the opposite sex's hormones. And then children at 18 should be eligible for reassignment surgery. That's what the kind of official medical professional associations and the gender experts. But many doctors object to this, and many of them can't say so publicly for fear of professional repercussions. So I had a number of medical school professors and practicing physicians who helped me with the research for this book, but they asked me, do not mention my name. I will lose my job. I'll lose my practice. I'll be punished if I speak out on this. There are a number of physicians who entirely agree with everything that Dr. Paul McHugh says, but they don't have the courage or the job security to say it. And McHugh, if listeners aren't familiar, back in 1979, when he was the chair of psychiatry at Johns Hopkins Hospital and the psychiatrist-in-chief, he shut down the sex reassignment clinic at Hopkins. And it remained shut down for over 30 years. It only opened up again last year when Johns Hopkins gave in to the demands of LGBT activists who were requesting that they censure Dr. McHugh and that they reopen the clinic. The hospital and the medical school refused to in any way censor McHugh, but they did reopen the gender clinic. And many physicians are concerned about that.
We're talking about transgenderism with Dr. Ryan Anderson. He's William E. Simon Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation and author of the book, When Harry Became Sally, Responding to the Transgender Moment. When we come back, is it also a medical market? Stay tuned.
Your body is yours at the end of the day. And don't let the hateful try and take it away. We want to be free, yeah, we go our own way. And our body was made.
Did you make a New Year's resolution to get in shape this year? You'll find quality personal training and qualified instruction at Performance Fitness at Edwardsville. You can even work out for a full 30 days before making a commitment to join. Visit them on the web at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness can help you keep your New Year's resolution. Performance Fitness in Edwardsville. Performancefitness618.com.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
People have confused pietism with piety and dumped piety along with dumping pietism. It's resulted in a real confusion about this.
Pastor Will Whedon, on his presentation at the 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, making the case for godliness.
Any thought about dealing with how we actually live our lives is regarded as being, that's law. That's what we've been freed from. We don't have to think about that. Well, no. The whole point is, what does it look like to live with Jesus Christ having been crucified and raised from the dead?
You can meet and hear Pastor Whedon Friday, June 8th and Saturday, June 9th at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Collinsville, Illinois. Collinsville is 15 miles east of St. Louis. For more information, just look for the Making the Case logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, or call 618-223-8385.
Now something meets boy and something meets girl. They're both the same, they're overjoyed in this world.
Expert guest, expansive topics, extolling Christ. That's exactly what you'll find at the 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. You can meet and hear Hank Hanegraaff, Craig Parton, Scott Klusendorf, Will Whedon, Angus Manouge, Jonathan Fisk, all of them discussing topics like scientism, abortion, Islam, the prosperity gospel, the doctrine of justification, godliness, and more. It's the premier conference for Christian laity, the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 8th and Saturday, June 9th in Collinsville, Illinois, about 15 miles east of St. Louis. Early bird registration is $110. That includes three meals. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org. We're talking about transgenderism. Dr. Ryan Anderson is our guest. William E. Simon, Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation, author of several books, including his latest, When Harry Became Sally, Responding to the Transgender Moment. Ryan, I don't want to trivialize this, but I got to know, is this also the transition system, so to speak, is this also a new medical market?
I wouldn't view it primarily through kind of an economic analysis. I wouldn't think that, you know, this is being driven by people who can make money on these gender clinics. I think this is largely driven by some people who are entirely well-intentioned but are extremely misguided. And so they think that what they're doing is in the best interests of children with gender dysphoria. They believe that human nature and the human body is entirely plastic. It's entirely malleable. Therefore, it's just raw material that can be assigned and reassigned at will. And then I think there are other people who are just ideologically driven. They want it to be the case that the body is entirely malleable and plastic. And so if they can succeed on the question of gender identity, then every other aspect of our identity, especially our sexual identity, would be freed from any normativity.
Where do we stand legally with respect to laws in the United States as we speak on this issue?
Nowhere is any of that standard of care, which I just mentioned, unlawful. Physicians can do this to children in all 50 states. And yet it's unlawful for physicians in seven states to do what Dr. McHugh would suggest, because those states have labeled it, quote, conversion therapy for a medical professional to talk to a child to, quote, try to change the child's gender identity. It's an Orwellian definition. So if you want to take a boy and transition him into a girl, that's legal. But if you want to take a boy who thinks he's a girl and feels like he's a girl and help him identify as a boy, that's unlawful conversion therapy. It's not conversion when you take the boy and transition him into a girl, but it is conversion when you take the boy and you try to help him identify as a boy. And that's been made illegal for medical professionals to do with minors in seven states. And it's an abuse of language, and it's an abuse of law, preventing physicians from practicing good medicine. Under the Obama administration, in the last year of that administration, there was a mandate, the second Obamacare mandate that was very controversial, that said every physician would have to perform sex reassignment therapies if they were qualified to do so. So if you're an endocrinologist that does hormone therapy for men with low testosterone, you would have to do hormone therapy for women who wanted to become men. If you were a surgeon who did hysterectomies or mastectomies because of cancer, you would have to perform those hysterectomies and mastectomies on women who wanted to become men. There were no protections for religious liberty. There were no protections for conscience. There were no exemptions even for medical best judgment. So for physicians who think this is bad medicine, they would still have to perform it. Thankfully, that was struck down by a judge, and then the Trump administration did not appeal the judge's ruling. But we can expect this to come back as soon as we have a different presidential administration. We can see this take place at the state level. Right now, there are two Catholic hospitals that are being sued because they declined to do sex reassignment surgeries. Those lawsuits are taking place in New Jersey and California under state anti-discrimination law. So we're going to see legal challenges in the years to come, because one side wants to say we should let adults do what they want to do, but we shouldn't force doctors to do it against their best judgment, and we shouldn't encourage children to transition. The other side wants to say the only acceptable medical response to gender dysphoria is reassignment, and therefore anything else has to be prevented, and the good stuff, as they see it, needs to be mandated.
Finally here, we had talked kind of about the classic case before. This is one of which I know personally, tragically, a former Lutheran pastor explains his transition from male to female this way, simply put, and I hope I don't oversimplify. He says, I know I'm a man. I know that. Genetically, I'm a man. But I had to do this. I must live as a woman, full 9 yards of transition. If I don't, I will die. If I don't, I was going to sooner or later kill myself. What are your thoughts there?
It's hard to know without knowing the details of the case, but one question would be what sort of other therapeutical assistance had this individual received? Had they met with someone like Paul McHugh? Had they met with a psychiatrist or a psychologist who's trained in gender identity conflicts and gender dysphoria? The second thought is I wouldn't automatically exclude the possibility that for someone who thinks that the only way that they will avoid self-harm is by transitioning, that may be a possibility under the same way in which you would amputate a limb that's diseased in order to save the whole body. What you would want to avoid, and the way that you describe this case, the individual did avoid it, is that they're not doing this because they actually believe they're, you know, a woman trapped in a man's body. They're not doing this on that basis, but they're doing it because their feelings of gender dysphoria are so severe and no other treatment has responded. And so this is kind of like a last chance effort to relieve the feelings of distress. That said, we don't really have good evidence that this is successful at that. When we look at the suicide attempts and then the completed suicides, people who have transitioned are 19 times more likely to die by suicide. So again, this is an area where there are just a lot of unknowns. And so it really calls for caution and careful consideration.
Is this just the beginning? You called it a moment, but is this just the beginning for other more bizarre things to come?
It's definitely just the beginning in the sense that 5-10 years ago, most Americans had never even had a conversation about gender identity and gender fluidity and transgender identity. But the reason that I describe it as a moment, and I take that phrase from the first footnote in the book, goes to about 8 different newspaper reports that have described America being in a transgender moment. These are left and right, secular and religious sources that have said that. And I take their use of that phrase and make it a further point to say this moment will be fleeting. That doesn't mean it's going to go away on its own. That doesn't mean it's not going to be a contested issue in the meantime. But from the perspective of 50, 100, 150 years from now, people will look back on this and say, what were we thinking? Transgender identities and transition surgeries are not going to be around for the long term, because eventually you can only deny human nature for so long. And the failure to live in accordance with the truths of the human person will eventually catch up to itself, and people will recognize that.
Dr. Ryan Anderson is William E. Simon Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He is author of several books, including his latest, When Harry Became Sally, Responding to the Transgender Moment. When you purchase this book using the Amazon link at our website, a percentage of your purchase will help support the worldwide outreach of Issues, etc. Just go to issuesetc.org, click Listen on Demand, and look for When Harry Became Sally by Ryan Anderson. Dr. Anderson, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
When we come back in Hour 2 of Issues, Etc., we're going to continue our series introducing the books of the Bible. Today, Deuteronomy, the last of the books of Moses, the Pentateuch. Interesting little fact, when Jesus is being tempted by the devil in the wilderness and he quotes Scripture, he quotes only one book, Deuteronomy. We'll talk about that with Pastor Brian Wolfmiller after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues, Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues, Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.